the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
This evening, for this passage, the parable of the shrewd manager. Difficult stuff. So we're in this series, and we're looking at small stories containing big ideas. And today, this parable is it only occurs in Luke, in Luke's gospel. So there's no help from other of the synoptic gospels to give us any light on this. So that's why it's a bit tricky to explain. Brad Young argues that the parable of the unjust steward, or the unjust manager in the NIV that you've got there, is regarded as one of the most, if not the most perplexing, of the parables of Jesus. And James Edwards, in the most recent commentary that I could find on Luke, argues that the parable known as the dishonest steward, or the dishonest manager, presents a, or the shrewd manager, it's got a lot of names, hasn't it? What are we calling it? We're calling it the shrewd manager. The shrewd manager in the NIV. He says it presents a unique challenge because it begins with a master dismissing a steward for dishonesty, yet ends with a master praising the steward for a greater act of dishonesty. There are many ways of interpreting this parable, and tonight I'm only going to explore one of those interpretations, the one that's sort of most spoken to me about what this is about. Other interpretations are available, so do let's discuss it. I don't feel I've completely understood this, so I'll give it my best shot. My argument is that this parable is not a model that we should follow. In my understanding, Jesus tells the parable to expose the failings of two ways of being religious, leaving only one way for the disciples to follow. One way of being religious is to think about money as tainted, as sinful and evil. And so you just bury it in the ground, or you hand it over to somebody with fireproof gloves, because it really is dangerous stuff. Or the other way of being religious is to love money and cuddle up to it. You worship money because it is the way to achieving your ambitions in the world. And then, of course, there's what Jesus teaches about money, which we'll come to eventually. Now, why would you think that money has to be handled with fireproof gloves in the first century Palestine? So just go with me for a moment. This is probably far too roundabout a way of going, but let's go with it. Indulge me. Imagine you're the ruler of a vast empire. You have a vast army. Let's say your headquarters are in Rome, and you decide to send out your army to a distant land. And as you know, armies march on their stomachs. So you need to find food to feed your army. The only way to obtain food is from the people in the distant land who are growing it. So how do you get the food from the people in the distant land to feed your army? Well, one of the things you could do is to use violence. You could kill them and take their food. But the problem with that is that next year, who's going to grow the crop and who's going to feed your army then? So no, that won't work. You can't use violence out and out. So then you think to yourself, well, I could use money. The soldiers I've sent have got money. Maybe they could buy food. But then you realise that won't work, because the people in the land have their own currencies. They don't need the Roman money. So you think to yourself, that won't do. How are we going to get the food? So then you think, I need to find a way of making the people in the land need the Roman money. And so you come up with this great idea called taxation. And you tax the people in the distant land and say, you have to pay this tax in the Roman money. So how are you going to get it? And the people go, I know, we'll sell you our food. And they go, that's a great idea. So the food is sold, the army gets its food, they get the Roman coins to pay the tax, and then they realise they're really impoverished through this process. And the Romans, they think, oh, this is quite good, actually. Now we can grow even more food, raise the taxes a bit, and maybe start selling the food overseas, and we can make even more money on this. And the people get poorer and poorer. So that's why money is a toxic good for some people in the first century. We have to remember that discussions about money were set against the backdrop of empire. Money, power, taxation, and the poverty of the people, they all were part of the same picture. And the people asked, where is God in all of this? As they got poorer and poorer. And we ask the same question today, where is God in all of this? Well, Jesus was God in all of this. In the midst of this situation, he told parables to show how it is possible to live under the rule of God in a land that was ruled by an empire that used money and taxations as weapons against the people. So, what does the parable teach about renouncing money as evil, toxic, put on the fireproof gloves, or about cozying up to the money and getting with empire? Well, I don't know about many of you if you've done a jigsaw lately. I haven't done one for a while, but I know when I do a jigsaw, what I like to do is to find the outside pieces first, yeah, nodding, because the straight edge gives it away and you can work out where it belongs. And I think it's great with Luke's gospel that we've got some straight edges to help us work out what the parable might mean. So the first straight edge in Luke is the emphasis on the poor. Right the way through Luke, the gospel according to Luke, it reveals Jesus Christ as coming because God is keeping his covenant with the poor, the outcasts, the lowly, the least, and the lost. And you don't have to go very far in Luke, do you, to see this? Chapter 1, Mary's song. He's filled the hungry with good things, but he sent the rich away empty. Chapter 2, Jesus was born, and it was the shepherds that were told first, the ordinary poor of the land. And of course, Jesus comes from highest heaven to lowest earth, doesn't he, in humility. Chapter 3, John the Baptist, his message to the wealthy, don't extort money, don't accuse people falsely, be content with your pay. Chapter 4 quotes Isaiah 61, Jesus' first sermon, the Spirit of the Lord is on me to preach good news to the poor. So we could go on. Luke's got this straight edge about the poor. And the second straight edge, I'm going to call middlemen, because I have to be politically correct these days, middle agents. I mean, they probably were all men, to be honest, but there may have been one or two women. Let's call them middle agents. Middle agents are people who live off the coattails of the rich, and they do the work of making the money flow from the poor to the rich in first century Palestine. Now, it's not my idea. So, Rachel Maguire, she's the pastor at Emmanuel Baptist Church in New York, and in her doctoral dissertation, she says that the gospel according to Luke reads like Gospel 101 for middle agents. And if you're confused about this, I don't know whether this will help. Michelle said this was a bad idea, but I mean, it never works when you go against your wife's advice, but here we go. She has this diagram in her PhD thesis. And she said that on the right, you can see the agrarian peasants and the artisans. That's the majority of people in first century Palestine. There's the people who grow the food, work on the land. There's Jesus, the carpenter, the artisan. And then on the far left-hand side, bottom left-hand corner, we have a tiny minority of people, 2%, who own well over half of the wealth. It's a very unequal society, much in the same way that our own world is very unequal. But then she says there are these middle agents in the middle. And the ones I want to draw your attention to are the insider collaborators. So the ones I want to draw your attention to are the ones who are closest. Let's try that again. Oh, yeah, I've got my thing. The ones who are closest here, the insider collaborators, these are the closest socially and in terms of physical location to the people of the land. And they are drawn from the members of this oppressed community, and they are insiders to that community. And they manage the extraction of resources on behalf of the elite. And within the insider collaborators, we have religious leaders, like the temple leadership, and we also have the landowners and the tax collectors, like Zacchaeus, and people who are soldiers, perhaps drawn from the Samaritans, who Samaritans were recruited by the Romans to form part of the army there, to keep people in order. So they weren't well-liked at all by the agrarian peasants and artisans. And as we know from reading the Gospels, Jesus spends a lot of time with these insider collaborators, like Zacchaeus and the rich young man. And he challenges them to change their allegiance from the occupying elite to the poor of the land. Because worshipping God in spirit and in truth means practically serving the needs of the poor. Remember what James says in his letter. James 1:27. Religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless is this: to look after orphans and widows in their distress and to keep oneself from being polluted by the world. So that's our second straight edge, God's call of repentance to middle agents. And finally, we have God's eternal plan for a restored creation. And this morning we heard from Richard in his talk about the very end of the Gospel of Luke, about the resurrected Jesus and as a foretaste of the restored creation. So that eternal perspective is our third straight edge. So we bring these straight edges to our puzzle. Let's see where it takes us. So a master from the elite class in society, has entrusted a middle agent to look after his possessions. The manager is dealing with those who are indebted to the master. And the sums we're talking about are large. 3,000 litres of oil was the harvest of around 150 olive trees. 30 tons of wheat was the harvest of 100 acres of land. These debtors are not poor. And the quantities are owed are so large that quite a few people think they're wholesale merchants rather than farmers. So the system's working well for the manager, until he's accused of wasting his master's possessions. And the accusation is evidently from a trusted source. He doesn't go and question it. And the silence of the manager indicates that it's a valid accusation. So this is fair cop. The manager weighs up his options. He's not strong enough to dig. He's too proud to beg. So then he has this brilliant aha moment. I know what I'll do, verse 4. So that when I lose my job here, people will welcome me into their houses. And as we know, he's very clever. And he invites each debtor to a private audience. And the debtors don't realise that the manager has lost his job. He's been fired. So they grant him the usual authority. If they'd known he'd been fired, they would never have risked the loss of public honour and the shame that comes from that in dealing with an illegitimate person. So the shrewd manager reduces their debts by large amounts, the equivalent of a year's wages, and Kenneth Bailey argues that, it's no relation, by the way, Kenneth Bailey, just happens to have a great surname. He argues this is what's happening. He says this is probably what's gone on. Take your bill, sit down quickly and write 1,500. This means sit down before my master takes the bills from me and write 1,500 instead of 3,000. And as for the extra 1,500, they will be divided between the two of us after all this is over. Yee-hee. So we're both going to win from this. And he brings the debtors into the deception. So the manager is clever because now he knows that the debtors are implicated in the ruse. So they can't go off to the master and go, oh, you know, your manager's corrupt, because now they are corrupt too. So you would expect the master to be furious, wouldn't you, for this second act of dishonesty. But actually, the master praises the steward for his shrewdness. The manager's strategy was clearly the work of a very shrewd operator. So the question is, what sense can we make of this? Is Jesus commending dishonesty? Is Jesus commending this type of shrewdness to us? I don't think so. What kind of character do I regard as the modern equivalent of the shrewd manager? I seem to have lost a slide here. Oh, well, I was going to suggest the character of Sir Philip Green, if you've heard of him. You may know that he was very shrewd. He was a very shrewd owner of British home stores. And he made lots of money from that. I think it was sort of like 500 million or something, or more maybe. Whilst the pension deficit in the pension scheme grew larger and larger. And he was a manager in a very self-interested way. And he also won lots of friends with his wealth, like people like Simon Cowell from The X Factor. So he's Sir Philip Green, and he's still Sir Philip Green. He retains his knighthood despite all of the protests. So he's the closest I could kind of find to the shrewd manager in our own culture. Maybe you can think of better examples than that. So in verse 8, the story concludes, the master commended the dishonest manager because he had acted shrewdly. For the people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind than are the people of the light. Verse 8 perhaps provides the key to interpreting the parable. Perhaps. So, professor of early Christianity, David Flusser, has argued that the people of the light is a reference not to Christians, because remember at that time there weren't Christians, that was a name that was given to the disciples later in history. It was not used for the followers of Jesus, but for a community that wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Essenes. And in fact, this is the only reference to the people of light in the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. So who were the Essenes? These were people who treated money with the fireproof gloves. They didn't like it. They were a group of radical Jews who went out to live in the desert in isolation, and they turned away from the world to seek purity. And turning away from the world meant renouncing money. And they called the money of the outsiders to their community the wealth of unrighteousness, which in the NIV Bibles that you have is translated worldly wealth. Or I like the King James better, actually, that says the mammon of unrighteousness. That's the one I like best, the mammon of unrighteousness. So the Essenes thought that all money was dirty and you couldn't use it without being tainted by the idolatry it represented. Remember all those Romans and what they do with money and all that kind of stuff. But Jesus tells the parable, he tells the parable to criticize the Essenes' relationship to money. The Essenes should have been using their money to care for the needs of the poor. but instead they were burying it in the ground. It's symptomatic of a religion that is turning inwards to ever greater searching for ritual purity. So the parable works to ridicule the Dead Sea sect, the Essenes, and their way of life. Jesus says in verse 9, "I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous wealth, so that when it fails, they may receive you into the eternal dwellings." The disciples listening to the parable would have understood the irony of the exploitative manager doing far better than the Essenes out in the desert. It's a bit of a dig. Verse 9, "Use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourselves, so that when it is gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings." So our use of money has eternal significance. Worldly wealth, what they called unrighteous mammon, can and should be used for holy and eternal purposes. So the test of your faithfulness is how you use unrighteous mammon. And by the way, mammon, this personification of money as a living entity, refers to the Hebrew word aman, which is the word we get our word amen from. And aman means to place trust in. To place trust in something or somebody. So when we say amen, we're saying that we're trusting God. So we have to be very careful with mammon, money, because it can so easily gain our trust. So the test of faithfulness is how we use this unrighteous mammon. And we learn that the Pharisees, now this is another religious group, loved money. They're the ones who want to cozy up to it and stroke it like a cat. So the test of faith, the Pharisees, these are the ones who love money. Verses 14 and 15. "The Pharisees who love money heard all this and were sneering at Jesus. And he said to them, 'You are the ones who justify yourselves in the eyes of others, but God knows your hearts. What people value highly is detestable in God's sight.'" So the Pharisees were like the shrewd manager in the parable. They used money from motives of self-interest, and their hearts were as bad as rotten apples. So the parable works to criticize two ways of being religious. First of all, those who reject money and withdraw from the needs of others. And secondly, those who use money in superficial and self-interested ways. Jesus instructs his disciples in verse 11, "If you have not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will trust you with true riches?" How we use money matters to God. Theologian Karl Barth said that your ethics are the test of your dogmatics. And what he meant by that was the way you live reveals the authenticity of your beliefs. What you do reveals what you're thinking and what your heart is like. So what does your use of money reveal about your character? What does your use of money reveal about your commitment to God? Rachel Maguire sums up the Pharisees' position as middle agents, and she suggests that Christians in the West today are in the same position. Middle agents have a habit of superficially following Torah law and the gospel, while fastidiously shoring up our position and our wealth. This is the great temptation for Christians in the developed world who have savings in the bank. We're tempted to find ways of paying less for our lifestyle than is fair to the workers and producers in the developing world countries that staff call centres, factories and farms. And that's why it's so important to get behind fair trade initiatives. And I'm really proud that here at Belmont we're a fair trade church and we're supporters of fair trade, because fair trade causes us to ask questions about the causes of poverty in our world. Oxfam suggests that if you have £48,300 or more in cash and assets, this puts you in the top 10% of wealthy in the world. And this means that you're a middle agent in our world. Or to be honest, if you've got any money in a bank, in a savings account, you're a middle agent in our global world. I was surprised when I was in Colombia, in Bogota, and I calculated what I could get for my house if I sold it, and where I could live in Bogota. I could live like a king in Bogota. I could live in the centre of London, the equivalent of the centre of London. And I was surprised, not a very posh house in Exeter, you could live like a lord in Bogota, Colombia. We sometimes don't see the wealth that we have. So what should middle agents do? And I'm feeling very uncomfortable at this stage with this challenging message. Tim Chester has this suggestion. Giving is the way in which we affirm and confirm the lordship of God in our lives in the place of the lordship of money. It is the way in which we reassert our control over money, liberating ourselves from its control over us. In a society where money is everything, giving is a powerful, subversive act. It is an act of defiance. So, are we like the Dead Sea sect, the Essenes, accumulating money in the bank and living without generosity? Or are we like the Pharisees, who love money and only gave it away to secure their survival and self-interest in a very unjust system? Or are we storing up treasures in heaven through our generosity, making friends with the poor? Again, Rachel Maguire must have one of the last words on this for her excellent work. She says this: Jesus presses middle agent listeners to decide where true power resides in the world, what belongs to Caesar and what belongs to God, and thus decide their allegiance. Will I join Jesus and the majority of the world, for example, Zacchaeus? Or will I return to my imperial life? And the example there, the rich young man who turned away sad because he loved his money more than he loved the way of Jesus. Will I return to my imperial life and continue helping consolidate power in the hands of a minority elite? So this is a parable for our times. Just to close, you may have seen this last week, reports in the Observer of the richest 1% are on target to own 2/3 of all wealth by 2030. It's a more unequal world than in the time of Jesus. So money can be a tool of empire and the elite. Money can be an idol we worship and cozy up to, yet money can be used to worship God in building friendships and reaching out to the least and the lost.